their Greek Belgique.
Get out, you noisy little kid.
Look out, Margate, and look up your daughters, eh?
Hello and welcome back to the Jolly Boys podcast. It's a lovely sunny Friday here in Peckham. And today is a very special episode because we are joined by one of our long supporting fans, James, or you might know him as Jimothy Shondells. How are you doing, James?
Yeah, I'm all good. Thanks, Chris. How are you?
I am very well. Thank you so much for joining us and your ongoing support for our podcast. We always like to see your name pop up.
No, absolute pleasure. It's a thrill, actually, to come on and talk things only for supporters. So it's a programme that I absolutely adore and don't get a chance to speak about it too often. So,
well, tell us a little bit about where your love for the show started and how long have you been watching it for, and was it a thing that you got into through your parents?
Well, I'll tell you what, I can't remember a time where I haven't watched it, if that makes sense. So clearly there was when I was a child. But it was a presence in the house when I was growing up. My dad really liked it. Like, my mum really liked it. Everyone liked it. You know, the Christmas time, the Christmas specials were booked in. You know, dinner wasn't allowed to be around that sort of time. Everyone had to be in front of the telly. And for me personally as well, being a bit of a scribe, an aspiring one, John Sullivan to me is one of my all-time heroes. And I can't think of a single... There's not an episode that would come on the telly, for example, that I wouldn't sit down and watch if I had the time, or at least have it on in the background.
Yeah, that's just like me. So what are your favourite episodes, or what is your favourite episode?
Oh, I mean, how can you choose between your favourite children? Do you know what I mean? It's difficult. I would say the ones that I like, the ones I think about the most are It's Only Rock and Roll, for example.
That's a great episode, and that's not an episode that we hear a massive amount about, really. It's kind of one of those episodes that sort of flies quietly under the radar. I don't know why, because it is a really, really strong episode.
Yeah, I think so. And being in bands and things as well, maybe that resonates with me a little bit more on that tip.
If you pardon the pun.
Yeah, definitely, yeah. I've only got one drumstick. I don't know where the other one's been shoved. I can't remember. But what else do I like? Obviously, like, you know, Jolly Boys outing and to have a back and sort of all the 50-minuters are always up there. But when it comes to the first few sort of series, I mean, the episode we're going to do today is Classic Fools, isn't it?
It is a really, really good episode. And some of the fans that reached out on Twitter are claiming it's the best 30-minute Only Fools and Horses episode, which is quite a big statement to make. But I'm not sure I disagree.
Well, I mean, no pressure there then, is there? No, definitely not. You got a little bit of location shooting. You got some stuff going on in the flat down the Nag's Head. It's got a little bit of everything, hasn't it?
It is a really, really strong episode, and it's got the strongest recipe for a good Only Fools and Horses episode.
Absolutely, yeah. I'm looking forward to getting stuck into it. But as I say, any episode that comes on, even the later three that I know sometimes people get a bit sniffy about them, but I'll watch any of them really, and it's. It's always really good to watch one come on UK Gold or BritBox that I haven't seen in a long time. And you kind of forget little bits, which is amazing when you've actually watched it so many times before anyway.
I know exactly what you mean. Well, I've got a bit of a confession to make, actually. I've not really watched Only Fools and Horses now since they pulled it. But I didn't pull it from Netflix. It expired from Netflix and it's been gone for quite a while. So I really need to get a BritBox subscription or drag my brick DVD player upstairs to the bedroom and start watching some old-fashioned DVDs and get Only Fools and Horses again on from fresh.
Well, if you want, mate, I know a geezer does a fine line in Rajar Computers. $299 they retail for, but to you, $150.
You've left it in my vestry? It sounds like a bargain. So today we're talking about the episode Healthy Competition, which is episode 2 of season 3. And this is a very, very special episode because it's when we, the fans, are introduced to Mr. Patrick Murray, a.k.a. Mickey Pierce. And it's a bit of an interesting subject, really, because Only Fools and Horses, in my opinion, wasn't necessarily the making of Patrick Murray, because he had quite a successful TV career before he was cast as Mickey Pierce, which is interesting because I think a lot of the fans presume that Only Fools and Horses was what kind of made his career. But if I remember correctly, I believe John Sullivan saw Patrick Murray on a television commercial. And at this point, Mickey Pierce hadn't been cast. And John Sullivan took one look at Patrick Murray and said, pointed at the TV and said, "That is my Mickey Pierce." And the rest is history.
Mate, Pizza Hut have made so many stars. Patrick Murray, Gareth Southgate, Stuart Pearce. It's amazing.
That's a great bit of knowledge, because I couldn't quite remember what the TV advert was, but I remember as soon as you say Pizza Hut, of course it was.
It was. And I think it was either John Sullivan or it might have been maybe Ray Butts. I can't quite remember if I've read it in a book somewhere, but someone definitely spotted him and went, "That's Mickey Pierce." And when you think about the vast array of supporting characters in Only Fools, for my money, everyone that gets cast in each of those individual roles, no matter how small, brings something to the table. And it's, you know, that real ensemble. Everyone always remembers Del Boy, Rodney, Grandad and Albert, but it's a real ensemble piece, isn't it?
I completely agree. That's a really good way of articulating it, actually. Even the one-offs who are in it for 2 minutes are just so believable, aren't they? The cast and director just got everything so perfect with Only Fools and Horses. And this is, I don't know, I guess it's like it can be described as an illness that I have, where I've said this before multiple times on radio interviews in the podcast episodes, but when I look at David Jason and Nicholas Lyndhurst, I don't see them as, you know, living individual people. I just see them as Del Boy and Rodney. I don't like to think they exist any other way than that. And that's how I feel about every Only Fools and Horses character, just because it's just done so incredibly well.
Yeah, thank goodness you're not their agent, because they wouldn't get very much work, would they?
I wouldn't let them get any work. I wouldn't want them to be anyone other than the characters in Only Fools and Horses. But you mentioned Buster Merrifield, and that's going to lead me off onto another segue of conversation for the podcast. Buster Merrifield's grandson, called Stuart Andrews, who's appeared on social media recently, and he's been posting lots of rare and personal pictures of Buster, which has been absolutely amazing. And I managed to post some yesterday. And actors like Buster Merrifield and Leonard Pierce, especially, I don't know if it's because of the age the actors were or are, that not very much can be read about them online. And there doesn't seem to be any photographs or any other stories other than the stuff that we know. So when some Buster Merrifield stuff comes to light, it's always really, really interesting to see. Did you have a chance to see the photos that were posted?
I did, actually, yeah. And it was very strange not to see him with a big white bushy beard.
It was, but I had a few people tweet in saying that he was completely unrecognisable. But for me, but then again, I've got his autobiography, and there's a really famous photograph of him sat down, presumably in a bank, posing for some sort of bank shot. Maybe it was for the press when he, Milford-on-Sea, I believe, is where he used to work in his bank. But that's the first time I saw him without his beard. But it was a shock the first time I saw it. But looking at these shots of him when he must have been 17, 18 in the army, I can tell straight away that it was him just by his eyes. And his grandson, who submitted the pictures, is a dead ringer for him. He looks just like him, obviously minus the beard.
No way. I'm sensing a recasting coming on. We can do this.
That would be amazing. But I do often get sort of stuck down the Buster Merrifield rabbit hole in a Leonard Pierce rabbit hole, just to see if I can find any information that I've not found yet, just because there doesn't seem to be much about them, especially Leonard Pierce. I'd love to know more about him.
Yeah, I suppose it's difficult, isn't it? Because they're kind of from the old school. They were obviously in Fools and Horses when they were coming towards the end of their careers. And Buster, in fact, as you probably well know, didn't start acting until quite late into his life anyway.
Yeah.
And, you know, they didn't have things like the internet and Google and Facebook and stuff. So I guess all those kind of old photos would reside in a relative's attic somewhere in a box. And what a thrill for someone like Stuart to come out and put them up online. Brilliant.
Well, yeah, I guess so. I think that is probably right. But I think Leonard Pierce was quite an established actor, wasn't he, before Only Fools and Horses? Yet there seems to be only a handful of images. And I tried looking up where he was buried yesterday, and there's no known location of where he lies, which is quite odd, unless he's a pot of ashes somewhere in someone's house. But I would quite like to visit his grave. But yeah, I don't know if anybody knows where it is who's listening, but yeah, certainly give us a tweet because I'd be interested to know, but presumably somewhere up in London.
Yeah, answers on a postcard, please. As long as he doesn't get sucked up by a street sweeper, we're all good.
What was he? A kitten?
You're wrong.
That's such a good episode. Okie dokie. So would you like to get started with a synopsis of the episode Healthy Competition?
Healthy Competition. So depressed with his role as Dale's lackey, Rodney leaves Titco and sets up business with Mickey Pierce. At their first auction, they buy a load of broken lawnmower engines. Bit of a spoiler that, sorry. Should have just said lawnmower engines. But when Mickey flies to Benidorm with the profits, Rodney's left to reconsider his career path yet again.
I think everyone's seen this episode, haven't they? Anyone who knows Only Fools and Horses knows about the broken lawnmower engines.
Yeah, I know. It's just in this day and age, you're very worried about picking up spoilers from stuff on the internet, aren't you? Especially when new films come out. But yeah, I'm sure the regular listeners of this have watched it more than once.
Right, let's get stuck in. So here we go. Healthy Competition. So we're opening up to a scene of Derek Trotter selling some animatronic battery-powered puppies from a suitcase down the market.
Classic. I just love how John Sullivan come up with something new every episode for him to sell.
Little Prince William's got one, apparently.
I wonder if he's still got it.
It's amazing, isn't it? The sort of BS these market traders can sort of think up off the top of their head to do a quick sell. But I remember going to Bristol Market when I was a kid, and I just remember seeing characters like this all around. This is before I was even aware of Only Fools and Horses. They're just so quick-witted, aren't they? And they're just kind of like born with the gift of the gab.
Absolutely, absolutely. And David Jason doing his best Prince Charles there as well.
These are made in Burma, and Dale thinks that's a good place for toys to be manufactured. So Rodney is on the lookout, apparently, but he's kind of like staring into space. And it's quite an interesting scene. It's kind of a bit like Jaws, where the camera cuts to the top of the policeman's head, which I guess is very similar to a shark fin. Then it cuts back to Dale, and they're just blissfully unaware of, you know, the incoming doom they have if they get caught by the scruff of the neck by the old copper.
That's it. They've even got like a bootleg version of the Jaws theme going on. I wonder if John Williams has ever seen this and fancied putting in a cease and desist. I don't know.
I think so many people have tried ripping off the Jaws ego. In the moment where Dale realises the police as well, you kind of hear like the stereotypical stabbing knife music. It is such a rip-off of Jaws, isn't it? But the deep string, dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun. This is a great scene, isn't it? It's written beautifully, the way he runs through the sheet and someone's passing over the pots and he runs through the pots. It's like the really famous sort of chase scenes in cars where,
of course,
with like the fruit stools.
Here he comes. He done quite a lot of running, didn't he, David Jason? Like especially in the later episodes as well, he's still like running about in a big suitcase. Must have been such a difficult thing to like carry around. God.
He did very well. So there's, I'm just going to hit pause a second. So I was just going to mention some fans are picked up on some tiniest little things with this episode about how many doggies, puppies are in Dale's suitcase from the point where he drops them on the floor to how many he puts in the suitcase. And apparently the number of them keeps changing. So it's like a continuity error, basically, during filming. But whoever picked that up, fair play, because they must be really quick at counting.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, fair play to that person. Whoever saw that, geez, little cameo from a cat there. I wonder if he went on to do anything else. Like the cat in Coronation Street obviously had that lockdown, didn't it?
That cat is famous and has no idea how famous it even is.
Yeah, isn't it?
So another fan observation that was picked up during this scene. Apparently, Dale runs out of an alleyway to jump in the back of the three-wheel van with Rodney driving as his getaway driver. But apparently, Dale runs from an alleyway to jump in. But on the wider shot, you don't see the alleyway at all. So it'd be interesting to keep an eye open for that.
Yeah, that is interesting. Also, if you're kind of media savvy, you would notice the little edit from all the dogs chasing Dale just back there. Like he turned down the right-hand side. You can just perceive it. And then the dogs come running in.
Right.
There's the dogs. So how many have we got there? About 9. And how many was there before? Like 12 or something?
Yeah, something like that. Maybe some got lost along the way, the chase. And also as well, some of these dogs need to be fired because I think a few of them run the wrong way.
One of them definitely looks directly at the camera. That's a no-no.
They're not fit for Hollywood, those dogs. So we've just arrived at the scene where Del Boy bursts into the flat, slams the door behind him, throws the suitcase across the living room, and Granddad's got the nerve to look up and say to him, "Have you had a good day, Del?"
And that's the brilliance of John Sullivan's writing. Such a classic, ordinary, everyday thing to say. But in this situation, it's a classic killer one.
Granddad must know something's going on because Del's arrived at the flat with Rodney trailing behind him.
Yeah, he knows it's been a bad day at the office. And the catalyst for the episode as well, really. Rodney clearly doesn't want to be a lookout. He was practically asleep when he ran past him. So let's see how it unravels.
Rodney's not taking any responsibility for it whatsoever. He doesn't think he's done anything wrong.
I'm kind of Team Del in this respect. Rodney's job was to be the lookout, but clearly he doesn't want to do it. So
it's not the first time that Rodney's not been paying attention by the sounds of things.
Oh, the jam sandwich.
Yeah, Rodney misses a whole squadron of policemen apparently getting out of a police car.
He's an half exaggeration.
I love Granddad in this scene. Granddad's kind of like just sat down, kind of like watching this all unfold. He's quite happy to listen to them arguing.
So interestingly, I've read or heard a couple of times in interviews that Nick Lyndhurst and David Jason used to do all the heavy lifting, you know, set up the plots, the premises, get some jokes in there, et cetera, et cetera. And then Leonard would say one line from the comfy of his chair and the audience would just completely die for 5 minutes.
Is that right?
Yeah, and they'd look at each other and be like, you know, what are we, you know, how can we compete with that? And I think we get one of those lines in this episode later, don't we, I believe.
Well, the Wendy house.
That's the one.
Yeah.
Apparently the audience were on their knees for about 10 minutes laughing at that.
Yeah, that I've also heard the same thing. It's probably one of the funniest one-liners in the whole of Only Fools and Horses that I'm aware of.
Oh, it's got to be top five if you're finding the list, for sure.
Granddad has got some absolutely killer lines, hasn't he?
Yeah.
Throughout the whole thing, obviously the A Touch of Glass, you know, the whole script for Granddad during that episode is just phenomenal.
It is. So here goes Rodney. He's working up the courage to tell Del that he's had a change of heart working for Trotters Independent Traders.
It must be really difficult for Rodney because back then there was a recession on and there were literally no jobs. And if Rodney does want money, he wants it that badly that he kind of puts up with the treatment that he gets from Del.
Absolutely. Well, I mean, you know, I'm sure there's a bit of film familiarity there as well, though. He's known nothing about Del, really, growing up, looking after him, etc. So I'm sure Del likes to lean on that a little bit, as we well know. But a little bit of social commentary from Mr. Sullivan in there as well. He likes to drop those in, doesn't he, now again?
He does. I guess Rodney's come into that age as well, where he wants to sort of try and stand on his own two feet. And I guess he's got friends, close friends, such as, in quotation marks, Mickey Pierce. And Mickey Pierce has probably been feeding him loads of BS about all of his business adventures, and it's probably just making Rodney feel worse. The thing is with Rodney, he's kind of stuck between a rock and a hard place, isn't he? Because on one hand, he's kind of got Del as his brother. Then on the other hand, he's got Mickey Pierce as a so-called friend. And he just seems to struggle with his identity and pushing himself forward without sounding too deep, because he's kind of being crushed from both ends.
Yeah. Peckham's conscience. He does get knocked about a bit, doesn't he? Takes a few laughs along the way. But it's always interesting later on in the series is when he loses his job with Alan. And yeah. They're like, well, you know, what are you going to do? You've not been on the government's registers for years and stuff. And it's actually, whilst it's funny talking about it in the context of a sitcom, I do often sit there and think, what would he have done? You know what I mean? What forms is he going to fill out? Like, why is no one going to come and knock on his door and play that act, etc.?
I love the amount of folded over cash Dale carries around in his pocket. Presumably that's maybe what he's made from today at the market, but it seems like an awful lot of money.
Did we see him actually sell any of those?
No, but you never know. That might be in this second lot of what he was selling. That could have been an afternoon scene, and maybe he was down there in the morning. But well, then again, maybe Dale hasn't got a bank account because he doesn't want the government knowing he's alive. So maybe his bank account is his pockets. It is a really, really great scene when he passes the cash over to Rodney, thinking he's going to pass it all to him. And in fact, he kind of takes less than a quarter of the chunk and puts the large wedge back into his pocket and sends Rodney off with it.
Well, that's it. I've always told you, Rodney, everything's split right down the middle,
60-40. So we're now in the auction house.
Here comes the introduction of one Michael Pearce.
Here he is, young Mickey Pearce, looking very fly with his very iconic outfit. I believe. I'm just going to hit pause a second to talk about Patrick Murray. So okay. I've met Patrick Murray a few times over the years, and the first time I met him was at a convention, an Only Fools and Horses convention in Bristol back in 2009, I believe. And I got to spend a little bit of time with him, and I just remember him being a really, really nice guy. But one thing that I remember more than anything was I got a photograph of him wearing his hat. So I was wearing his hat with my arm around Patrick, and I've got them somewhere, these pictures, but I just remember being like so incredibly chuffed that I had a picture with Mickey Pearce wearing Mickey Pearce's hat, because it's such an iconic thing. It's kind of like a Scar Boy, isn't it, little get-up? Kind of like the Specials in Madness.
Yeah, a little bit of that two-tone thing going on. Yeah, for sure. When you put the hat on, did your voice change and give it the old, like, all right, Rodney?
No, I did feel like saying to him, night-night, Patrick, love you. I spoke to Patrick on the phone, actually, for about an hour just before the pandemic, because he wasn't come on to the podcast, but because of the fact we couldn't get together as a collective, it didn't happen. But hopefully we will get him on in the future. But
that'd be brilliant.
But yeah, he's certainly a great character. But I'm just going to hit play again, and we're going to carry on with the auction scene.
There he is.
He's so good, isn't he? Dale Boy sort of sticks his head in between their shoulders with a big cigar in his mouth, just to kind of like almost sort of give him a little elbow in the ribs and wind him up a little bit.
It's almost kind of the reverse of the copper. You could have had the Jaws music playing then, and his little face just coming in like.
That would have been great. That would have made this episode a hell of a lot better. So Rodney is, I'm just going to hit pause again. Rodney is being in full adult mode. He's really alert, isn't he, about what's going on in the room. He doesn't want any nonsense from Mickey Pearce. He's stood up all straight. He's taking notes because he really wants to make a success of himself, and he wants to prove Dale wrong. And this leads me to the question, does Rodney actually need Mickey Pearce, or is Mickey Pearce just that one person there for, I don't know, is it even emotional support? Do you know what I mean? It's kind of like when you're younger, if you're afraid to go to the dentist, if you get your friend to come with you, it just makes it a little bit easier for you. Do you know what I mean? It's kind of like a little bit of like ghost support, if you see what I mean.
I think it's, I think you're right. I think Rodney probably could do it on his own. He's obviously got experience of the auctions, going there with Dale probably so often. But the fact that, you know, when you're young, you want to do things with your mates, don't you? And if Mickey's been feeding him lines down the Nag's Head or the pizza parlour or whatever, and saying like, yeah, come on, let's go into business together, we can do it. Like, you've kind of got that, like, it's like Raquel says in Stage Fright. She says, you know, when I was doing Double Cream, I had someone there to help take the pressure off a little bit. It wasn't just me doing it on my own. So maybe there's a bit of that going on, you know? Yeah.
I think we've all had those nights down the pub with mates, and you all of a sudden think of what you think is a good idea, and then you put it into action and it kind of turns out not to be anywhere near as good or successful as you hope it would be. But surely Rodney is an intelligent chap. He must know that Mickey Pearce is full of hot air.
Yeah, I think he probably does on a level, but they are mates. And like, you know, if it went to plan and Mickey actually didn't screw him over later on, they could have probably done a little bit. Fair, and Rodney would have unleashed the apron strings a little bit more from Dale, but obviously that's not as funny as what we actually get. So
I'll tell you what I think it is, without getting too deep. I just think Rodney isn't confident enough to do this on his own, and that's what it boils down to. It could be anybody with him, but it just happens to be Mickey Pearce. But that's what it is. It's just Rodney's confidence is constantly knocked, isn't it, in one way or another. And this is just him really trying to prove himself to Dale that, you know, he is a man now. He's fully capable of doing better things than being a lookout down the market. He deserves more chances in life. This is deep, isn't it? This is really deep. No,
I like it, mate. It's good to go deep now and again. I think you're spot on. But the only problem is, as we see a bit later on in the scene, Del Boy is always got that little hook in him that won't let him quite get away. Yeah. And, he says, oh, I wouldn't bother going for lot 49 or whatever. And he's actually quite right, because it turns out to be those crappy motors. But he's always messing with Rodney's head somehow. And yeah, maybe that's why Rodney thinks, if I've got Mickey Pierce alongside me, we'll do a couple of these and I'll be doing it and I'll get ramped up and I can do it on my own sort of thing. I don't need Del, but he's picked to go down to an auction that Del Boy's at. So maybe it's partly his fault as well.
It seems like Del knows how this is going to play out exactly from the word go. He knows what mistakes they're going to make. He's almost set it all up himself and is just watching it all play out, which is quite sad, really, isn't it, when you think about it? But at the same time, I think he probably just wants Rodney to learn a lesson to maybe know that the grass isn't necessarily always greener.
Chris, I've got to say, I don't want to go too deep into that side of it, but there's a case to be made that Del Boy isn't a particularly nice person.
Right, yeah, there's all sorts of theories about that, isn't there, on online. Yeah. But I think what it boils down to at the end of the day is brotherly love. I think we should probably just leave it as that. Maybe tough love. But we've mentioned this in other episodes, at the very beginning. Del is like a dad and a brother and a mother to Rodney, isn't he?
Yeah.
So, I think that says a lot about their relationships. Anyway, so I'm gonna push play on this scene here where they're talking about the lot numbers and which lot specifically to avoid. An interesting thing about this, if you're in auction, I've never been to an auction before, but for instance, if your lot that you're interested in is number 10 and you know what lot Del is after, which is say 9, because I don't remember exactly what number it is on there, surely you'd have a look on the auction sheet or speak to the auctioneer beforehand to find out what that thing is. Surely you'd see it. If you're keeping an eye on an item, you'd probably know what's above that item and below that item.
Yeah, you'd like to think so. I mean, looking at the sheet, it would have a description, wouldn't it? But I think because this isn't probably strictly legit stuff, like the guy says, I think it's like all sorted agricultural machinery.
Oh yeah,
it?
Of course it is. So it's not necessarily listed as specifically lawnmower engines. Yeah, okay, that makes sense. It's a great line where Del says, you put in a bid, but just a minute ago when you scratched your bum. And they believe it. They actually think that they put in a bid for an item that they didn't want.
Yeah, well, poor Mickey's an auction virgin, isn't he, clearly? So, but that does make me laugh as well. And it also makes me a little bit scared about going to auctions, because one little flick of the elbow, and it cost you a couple of grand.
Yeah, sneeze, you might walk away with a car.
Well, at least you'd get home quick.
So this is the scene where Rodney's kind of wise up to the fact that Del might be trying to pull something over their eyes and just play it cool. Let's just see what goes on. Let's not make any decisions just yet.
Yeah, absolutely. That's what I mean. He's got into his head and kind of reverse psychology him into buying the tat.
I've just hit pause a second. So Mickey Pierce and Rodney think they're onto a good one. And this is fantastic editing, camera work, how it all works out. So they're looking at each other really pleased. Mickey's got this really cheeky grin, which is quite well known for, isn't it? It's quite an iconic look for Mickey.
Yeah.
And the camera all of a sudden cuts to a big pile of broken lawnmower engines. And it's just completely not what the audience were expecting. And it just really kind of like ramps up that laughter of just unexpected sequencing of events.
Yeah. And you can just imagine them looking at them now, and they're looking down thinking, what are we going to do with these?
I feel so sorry for them as well. And they're both wearing suits, you know, they're dressed like businessmen, or dressed how they think businessmen should dress. And they're just looking down on this massive pile of junk, effectively. And I just feel so bad for Rodney, but it gets worse. Right, I'm just going to push play now. Even the guy at the auction house is looking at them going, you actually bought this stuff? And he turns around and smiles at Del, and Del kind of like gives him a smile and like a nod.
It's harsh lessons, isn't it, for them to learn.
And of course, Del's gloating, comes over and, I told you not to buy it.
He said, you will insist on thinking, that's your downfall. It's always like that psychological thing going on. But I suppose if you are new to the auction scene as well, you're going to take a few lumps and bumps along the way. So best to get them out of the way early, I suppose. But when it's your own brother leading you astray, it must stick in your craw a little bit, I guess.
Mickey Pierce just looks blankly at it, just trying to think of ways to get out of the situation because he doesn't want to support Rodney, does he? He doesn't want to stick together as a partnership.
Well, he does, doesn't he? He kind of says, well, I'm going to go and get the bus or whatever. And he's like, Rodney's like, oh, thanks very much, partner.
I'm just going to hit pause again. So we've just gone past probably one of the funniest laughs in the episode with the whole, not just lawnmower engines, they're broken lawnmower engines.
Yeah.
It's so good. So I'm on 12 minutes, 55 seconds. And the scene I can see is Dell opening the back of the van to put in his winnings of what he just picked up at the auction.
Yeah.
But fans have noticed this, very eagle-eyed fans. I'm saying fans with an F because I'm about to talk about the van with a V. When Dow has opened up the three-wheeled van from the back of the van is not painted yellow on the inside of the door, but in later series it is, which is really interesting, and it's not something that I've necessarily picked up on.
Ah, see, always learning. I've never noticed that myself either.
Yeah, so it's keep an eye on it on the future episodes. But yeah, apparently that's the case. So it's not painted yellow here, but in future episodes it is. And maybe it chops and changes.
Yeah, just, fantastic.
So they came down on the bus and they're struggling knowing what to do with these lawnmower engines. And they're looking pretty sheepish around Dale, like they kind of like they both need a hug, don't they?
Any chance we can stick them in the back of the van, Dale? He's like,
in the back of my van?
So he's trying to teach some harsh lessons. And then I think sort of underneath that is the fact that he wants Rodney to come back and work with him again, obviously, in the partnership. Yeah.
He's just told them both, those lawnmower engines that they both bought at the auction house, just came out of Dell's van. Another expected gag that no one foresaw.
And then I love the second bit of that way. He's like, just find yourself a couple of Herberts with cash on the hip, like I did.
So funny. He's just so clever, isn't he, Dell? It's just such an amazing script. But John Sullivan used to say, write about what you know. So presumably he must have had friends in this situation.
Yeah, he used to knock around, didn't he, the markets and stuff, and sort of based a lot of characters, mannerisms of people we do in real life, which I think is fantastic. And
yeah,
that's probably why it rings so true, because you can watch it and think, this is the sort of conversation I can hear, you know, over the roads anytime.
So Rodney is very, very angry at Dell. Dell's just got into the van and Mickey and Rodney are stood there with our hands in their pockets, just knowing what to do. And Mickey Pierce suggests to just run away. He's like, I can't run away. They know my address.
That's what I mean. He's like, yeah, but they haven't got mine though. He's like, oh, thanks, partner.
Yeah, it's not very nice, is it? Poor Rodney. He doesn't seem to have any decent friends, really.
Can I request a pause?
Of course.
It's a bit unorthodox for a podcast because no one else is going to see it. But if I show you at least for corroboration, I met Patrick Murray at a convention about a year ago, just when the restrictions got a little bit lax.
Okay.
And I got him to sign a couple of things, and I thought you might want to just see this.
Oh, that's really cool.
The quote that we're just about to hear.
You said they were combine harvested.
Yeah, and then at the bottom, I've got him to put the whole...
The way you were talking, we're going to do a deal with Weetabix, and it's signed by Mickey Pierce. That's amazing. That's so cool. So is that just a signed photo? It looks like a vinyl.
Yeah, well, it's in a vinyl cover to keep it to keep the signature protected.
Okay, well, send me over a photo of that. I'll tweet that out so the fans can see what we're talking about. But that is a really, really lovely piece of memorabilia. And that's a photograph of Paddy that I've not actually seen before.
Oh, nice. Yeah, yeah. Two or three different ones. I thought that was the best because there's lots of dark areas to get the quote and the signature to pop and etc. So just as a little aside on that, I do collect Fools and Horses autographs. Not been doing it for very long. Only got about half a dozen or so far, but looking to increase that as we go along. So all good.
So is there anybody who you really want who you haven't got?
Well, I mean, obviously, David and Nicholas would be the dream. Just to get them on something, the one piece together would be awesome. But
yeah, so have you got either of their signatures separately?
No, I haven't. No. As I say, I'm a massive Star Wars fan, and I've got a huge autograph collection in regards to that. But Fools and Horses is kind of my television passion in that regard. So, but I only started about 6 months ago. So,
right. Yeah. Okay. Well, I'll tell you something really interesting, keeping on the same topic before we dive back into the episode. I was looking on eBay a few weeks ago. Let me just check my listings now to see if it's still on there. And I can't vouch to whether or not it's actually legitimate or not, but I found, I'll show you, I don't know if you can see. So what I'm showing James is a Mona Lisa poster, which has been hand signed by Sir David Jason. And it's on eBay at the moment for £49.99, which sounds ridiculously cheap for his autograph. But if you go onto the seller, it says it comes with a certificate of authenticity, and they also sell lots of other signed only horse and horses stuff.
I mean, considering at the convention this year, I think an autograph ticket for Sir David was about 125 quid.
Was it? I thought it was more than that. I thought it was 250. Maybe that was for other opportunities.
I think the 250 was for the meet and greet and a photo. I think if you want an autograph, it's an extra.
Right. So do you think that's a legitimate autograph then for 50 quid on the Mona Lisa poster?
It could well be. I will tell listeners now that a certificate of authenticity doesn't mean anything in this game.
Oh, okay, that's interesting. So maybe it isn't. Maybe it's a fake.
Yeah, people can just make those at home and say it comes with one. But if the signature's not genuine, then you're not going to get any comeback just because it's got a certificate. So just be very wary buying things off of eBay. Do your research. I mean, there's plenty of examples out there of his signature that are genuine. You can do a little compare and contrast and see. But if something's too good to be true, the old adage, you know, it probably is. So
okay, that's definitely good advice. So have you got anything signed by Leonard Pearce or Buster Merrifield?
No, you're joking. I wish, mate. Is your biography by Buster signed? Because I heard he did a few of those.
It is, yeah. I spoke about this in the previous episode. I paid a penny for it from Amazon, not knowing it was signed, and it arrived at my door, and I opened it, and I was like completely overwhelmed that it was signed by him. I couldn't believe it. But there are quite a few around. But if you have a non-dedicated version of the book, where it just says, for instance, best wishes, Buster Merrifield, that will go for an awful lot of money. But because I believe I bought my autobiography from a charity bookshop, so it was probably just donated to them, but it was in pristine condition, and it was addressed to someone called David, I believe. But the Leonard Pearce autograph is the really tough one to get hold of, but I do see them floating around from time to time. Whether or not they're legitimate or not, I don't know, but if you keep a keen eye out, they do pop up from time to time.
Yeah, going back to what we were talking about before with the photos of Buster, etc., I suppose a lot of family members, etc., would probably have signed bits and pieces knocking around, maybe in the loft or whatever, but I can't imagine too many Leonard Pearce signed, I don't know, 5x7 headshots from 1950 or 60 probably still exist, really. Do you know what I mean? I'm sure there'd be a few, but...
Yeah, well, I guess it's only a matter of time until someone clears an attic out and finds it in... You know, a signed autograph of a specific person is only worth as much as someone wants to pay for it. You know, if someone's not got any use for it, they'll stick it on eBay and people like you will have a chance to buy it.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, sometimes you do find a bargain. And I've got to say, a penny for that signed book is super.
It's incredible. Have you read his autobiography?
I haven't. No, I'd like to.
It's brilliant. It is quite sad, but it is very, very good. I find Buster Merrifield a really, really interesting person. It's probably because I don't know a massive amount about him. And, he passed away when I was fairly young. But just to know more about him is just like really fascinating for me.
Yeah, definitely. I'd agree with you. And Leonard as well. Like you say, any sort of tidbits or information you can find on those two is especially welcome, isn't it? Because, as we, you know, we're probably kids of the 80s growing up.
Yeah, what year were you born?
Well, 1980.
Okay, well, I was 85, so yeah, a little bit before me.
Yeah, yeah. So, you know, a lot of the information about them we probably wouldn't have seen because we wouldn't be actively searching for things like that when we were like age five or whatever. But, yeah. You know, it's great. I think people that are really passionate about the show, like obviously yourself and myself, will do that deep dive now just to learn more about their own personal histories.
Yeah, there must be some living relatives of Leonard Pearce around somewhere who might have memories of him.
Put the call out. Get him on the podcast.
Yeah, it'd be great. Well, I'm trying to get Buster's grandson on the podcast. That'd be amazing. But going back to Leonard Pierce, he did one of his last performances quite near where I live in the Bristol Old Vic, according to Wikipedia.
Right. Okay. What year was that?
I think it was just before he died. I can't remember off the top of my head, but it's fairly close to when he passed away.
So you would have been about what, one, maybe two, something like that.
Yeah, I can't remember exactly what year he passed away. Let me have a quick look.
I can't, you might have been a baby in arms, but you should have been outside that stage door with your autograph book. Come on.
That would have been the dream, wouldn't it? Right, let's have a little look and find out when Leonard Pierce died. Okay, so yeah, he died a year before I was born. You were three.
Yeah, so there you go. It should have been me, but you know, I live in London, so Bristol's a bit of a roll in the pushchair.
It is. Right, I'm just going to hit play now. So to rub it in a little bit more, Dell waltzes in with two punnets of lovely strawberries, which were probably quite expensive back then. And I'm guessing strawberries wasn't probably something that the Trotters ate very much, but he's doing all right for money. He's doing all right for business. You know, why not treat himself? Well, I say treat himself. He treats himself and granddad, but I don't believe Rodney gets anything, does he? Which is a shame.
That's right. It's all gone a bit Wimbledon at the moment. So we're tucking into a nice bit of strawberries. And doesn't he? I think he gives Grandad a little bit of housekeeping money, which Grandad will invest wisely on the GGs, if I'm not mistaken.
And I wouldn't have thought Grandad gets housekeeping money very often. And I don't know how much housekeeping Grandad does. I can't imagine him being a very good hostess, can you?
Well, there you go. I think Del Boy's just giving him a little cheeky extra tenner for himself. So, yeah, I know what you mean, though. I think Uncle Albert continues that trend, doesn't he? Where there's an episode later on where he hears people coming in through the front door and he's just sitting in the chair and he jumps up and starts like hoovering the floor.
That's what I do when I hear my missus coming back from work. Turn the PlayStation off quickly and get the feather duster out.
We've been there. So, yeah, young Rodney, Del Boy's just filling Grandad in on a tale of woe.
I'm just going to hit pause a second. So this scene is quite interesting because Dell walks out with two mugs, which are shaped like apples, to have a little celebratory drink on his success. But there's loads of interesting things around the flat. And by the kitchen door, there's a Hovis statue of the bread boy, which, funnily enough, was shot in Shaftesbury, which isn't too far away from where I live, on a place called Gold Hill. Do you remember the advert? It's like a really iconic advert of a boy pushing his bike up a cobbly hill in a long summer evening delivering bread, and at the end you see him go back down the hill with his legs off of the pedals, and it's just a lovely advert. But presumably the statue behind Dell is the boy from the advert.
Wowza, that's awesome. I wonder if that little boy got residuals for that.
I don't know. Funnily enough, I did look him up actually, because I think they did remake the advert, or they did an interview on the anniversary of the advert and spoke to the man who was the boy. But I can imagine that Hovis memorabilia that Dell has in his flat would be worth an absolute fortune today. So maybe he probably wouldn't have even needed that pocket watch. Maybe that the Hovis bread boy was the key to his success all along.
I wonder, yeah, he probably would have got about 10 grand for it or something, maybe, and he would have been super happy with that and walked off into the sunset.
It's strange, isn't it? All happens. And there's a few other things as well, isn't there, in the flat? There's the statue of DeMilo. Is that what it's called?
Oh, the Venus de Milo.
Or that one, yeah. I think that's what it is. Can you see it?
Yeah, I can see. Yeah, it's got no arms. What bloody good is that?
So, yeah, where's Dell picked that up from? Was it one of many? Or is he not selling it because he thinks it's broken?
It might be Grandad's, to be fair. It's just been tucked away up the back and everyone's forgotten about it, maybe. But yeah, with Del Boy, it's normally only got one thing missing, but that's got both arms gone, isn't it?
Yeah, it's pretty funny. But I love investigating these scenes in different episodes to see what they're wheeling and dealing. Right, I'm just going to hit play.
If you, as well, just in the background, you see those three bottles with the white labels?
Yeah.
If you squint, that could almost be Peckham Spring.
It could almost be Peckham Spring. So Grandad feels sorry for Dell. Feels sorry for Rodney. He knows Rodney's coming in. He's saying, come on, give him a break. Please don't mention anything. Rodney walks in looking a bit like a lost soul, clearly down, a bit depressed. Knows that Mickey Pierce stitched him up, but doesn't want to let on that he's been let down by his best friend. His sole of his shoe is hanging off of his foot.
Yeah, That's really good. Another thing that John Sullivan does really well is to set something up to pay it off later. And obviously that shoe comes back into play in the very last scene.
It does.
Great comedy writing.
So Rodney's helping himself to the strawberry. So whether or not those strawberries were for him or not, or they're just a spare punnet left over.
I think Del Boy's like, I'll let him have a couple of strawberries as long as he's not going to take the whole thing.
I'm surprised Dal's letting him have the strawberries considering how strict he is with his egg and chips.
Yeah, I was just thinking that actually. Rodney's been kind of banned from the kitchen area, and also I think his newspapers as well.
There's loads of garden rakes behind Rodney in this scene as well. Can you see?
Is that, yeah? That must be part of the agricultural machinery that he's picked up.
It could be. I've never noticed that before until today. Funnily enough,
actually, do you know what? I don't think I have either. Actually. Because it was always a premise of the show, wasn't it? The producers said that they'd have different furniture and different things in the background like every week because the lives that they lead, that's probably what happened.
Yeah. They look too good, though. They're all wrapped in some sort of cellophane to be picked up at an auction, but I could be wrong. Maybe they were brand new, but it seems to be a bit of a contradiction to have some loads of broken used lawnmower engines and some pristine cellophane-wrapped rakes.
Welcome to the Rake Podcast.
Yeah, the podcast where we dedicate everything to rakes.
Beautiful. So, yeah, I like Rodney's thinking about, obviously, he's going to get his accounts out in a minute. That's why he can't go out. And it's literally two bits of paper that always gets me.
So Dale knows all along. He spoke to Mickey Pierce's mum, and he knows Mickey Pierce has gone away abroad on holiday and met a lovely Swedish bird named Holger.
I actually did meet a Swedish girl called Helga once when I was on holiday in Amsterdam.
Maybe it was her.
Maybe it was. Maybe it was. My lips are sealed now. I can't go too much more into that story.
Dell is always one step ahead, isn't he? He just knows everything before it's almost happened.
Yeah, well, that's the thing, isn't it? He always finds out the information before he drops his bombs, gets his ducks lined up and takes them down. And unfortunately, he's at the end of that line, isn't he?
So now he's talking about going into the self-catering holiday trade. What, on a knicker? And he go, what is it? You've got a Wendy house. So the fans are picked up on this scene. When Grandad says it, he's not laughing. But when the camera cuts, he's in absolute hysterics, or what they call corpsing, where he literally just cannot move or speak, where he's just laughing so much.
That's right. So I imagine if the audience were laughing for so long, obviously they would they would have had to have stopped and edited it later to compile it into like a 5-second bit.
Yeah.
So that laughter could have been proper genuine from that sort of 5 minutes of everyone talking about. That's like a couple of light ales down the back there. I'll tell you what, Chris, I was having a drink up in London on Saturday, actually, and it was in East London, just walking down the street, caught my eye, an establishment called the Nag's Head.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah, so I was like, maybe we could go in there for a quick drink, like just, you know, for a bit. But as we got to the doorway, it very quickly dawned on us that it was a gentleman's establishment.
Okay, that makes sense. I remember going to a pub up in Blackpool called the Uncle Albert. And it was dedicated to Uncle Albert. Yeah, it's really strange. I think if you look on Twitter, you'll find some pictures of it. But I didn't actually go in for a drink, but I certainly took a few photographs outside.
Fantastic, that's great. Yeah, we didn't go in, but there was a young brunette dressed in a naval officer's uniform that tried to tempt us in, but we said, nah, we're all right.
Does she have nine fingers by any chance?
Now, this is one of my favourite bits of this episode coming up. This whole scene in the curry house is brilliant. And I'm sure as a seasoned watcher, you probably know what I'm going on about here. But when he starts talking to young Towser, there's a great bit of physical comedy going on throughout the whole of the conversation, which you'll probably know.
It is such a good scene, and that food always looks good. I'm a sucker for a good Indian food, and it just looks so nice here.
Yeah, I'm with you on that, mate. I'm with you on that. I've read David Jason's latest autobiography, and he dedicates a bit of a chapter to eating on screen, and he said he's got it down to a fine art.
Right, okay. It's so difficult, isn't it? Because I don't know if you'll notice this now, whenever you watch any scenes on TV or films where the actors are eating, they just seem to push their food around the plate and not actually eat it. Or you see them eat something, in the next scene, it'll be back on their plate again. It's just like a really weird thing to try and conquer.
Yeah, it's an absolute nightmare for continuity in editing, I think. So that's probably why they do that. But here we go. Look, so the physical comedy is like he won't let Towser have a drink of the wine. And it happens like three or four times. It's brilliant. And it's so subtle that obviously when I first watched the episode, I didn't notice it. Probably the 10th, I didn't notice it. But it's just John Sullivan playing again, just with a little bit of physical comedy in amongst all the dialogue. Fantastic.
Like you say, it's a very, very clever scene. But this is another one of these episodes where Del Boy has just thought everything through so thoroughly. So the money that he gave Rodney at the beginning to invest into his future, which led in the disaster of these broken lawnmower engines, Del knew all along that he could give Towser, young Towser, a bit of money to buy them back off of Del, so Del could get his money back. So it's all just a lesson for Rodney in Del doesn't lose out.
Hey, look, Del Boy knows the value of a pound. No, he's not going to give Rodney 200 of them and not to try and get it back at some point. But as we were saying before, like you say, Del Boy's planned all of this out in advance. I mean, bloody hell. Imagine if he was in charge of the country. Jeez.
Well, I say that, but Del doesn't even give Towser anything, does he? He just puts his money down and Towser thinks, okay, well, that's, you know, going to be my payment for doing what Del's asked me to do. And I wouldn't pay that bill if I were you. And the waiter comes in and kind of like swoops it and just walks off with it.
Yeah, superb. Absolutely superb. And then, but then Towser gets his own back later on though, doesn't he? He takes a few quid for himself. But yeah, that's what I'm saying. This one little scene, it moves the plot on nicely, but it's just two guys in a curry house doing a little bit of business, a bit of physical comedy going on in there. And the payoff at the end is he doesn't even get the money anyway. So it's just great.
It's such a clever episode, isn't it? When you think about it and you break it down like how we're breaking it down, I think before I used to watch it for what it was and appreciate it. But when you realize how fantastic the writing is in the plot and the story and the characters, I think it is the best 30-minute Only Fools and Horses episode, like what the fans are saying. I cannot argue with that. I think this is a really, really good episode. But we'll carry on watching it and we'll give it our rating out of 10 at the end.
Yeah, so, yeah, for sure.
So I'm just going to hit play.
This is the only time we see young Towser, isn't it, I think?
I believe so.
Yeah. There's all those fan theories about Ugandan Morris and Sunglasses Ron on the coach to Margate, isn't there?
That's right. Yeah, I tweeted about it the other day, but whether or not it's a conspiracy, I'm not too sure, but it's certainly food for thought, isn't it?
I love it. I love it. I think that's the sort of conspiracy theory I can get on board with, I think.
So with the scene now where Del Boy is explaining to Towser exactly what he wants him to do, what lie to weave up to tell Rodney to make it not hurt Rodney's pride, to make Rodney think that actually, despite the journey that I've just been on, it's kind of ended up all right. You know, things have worked out the way he wanted them to.
Yeah, absolutely. But then I suppose it could be a little spanner in the works that he drinks his wine, pays the bill with the money that he's given him. So then he loses out later because Towser's like, hold on a minute, I'm gonna have something back here. So he doesn't go all completely his own way. And that's through his own doing.
It is, but I guess that's a bit of a lesson to Del, isn't it? Yeah. Karma is probably the best word to describe that.
Here we are. Now we're at the Nag's Heads. Familiar?
I'm just going to hit pause just for a second. Just talk randomly, talk about the conspiracy, the other Only Fools and Horses conspiracy.
1 second, mate. Sorry, I just had a real frog in my throat then. Excuse me. Sorry.
I should be dragging you around old Kent Row, shouldn't I?
You ain't got one of them back massages, have you, as well?
So, yeah, I was saying about the conspiracy of, I think it's the first episode where Del walks into the Nag's Head. There's a woman sat to our right and it looks just like Tessa Peake Jones.
Oh, yes, I know who you're talking about. Yeah, go on.
It's just what everyone presumes it is, Raquel. But wow. you kind of don't see her face. It looks a lot like her. But to be honest with you, back in the 70s, that haircut was quite a common thing. In, you know, it just looked a lot like her. But I don't know. As far as I'm aware, it's not her. But there's also the conspiracy that Robbie Williams was in one of the later episodes. But when you look at it, it's not Robbie Williams.
No, Robbie Williams has definitely been in the Queen Vic, but I don't think he's ever been down the Nag's Head.
Yeah, it's funny, isn't it, these conspiracies that people weave up with these sorts of things. But yeah, I just didn't know if you were aware of the whole episode one with Raquel allegedly sat down in the Nag's Head.
No, I wasn't, to be fair. I'm pretty sure Tessa Peake-Jones would have mentioned it by now, the numerous interviews that she's given about the show. But I'll tell you what I'm more interested in. The lady who's an extra in the Nag's Head, two or three times, I think, throughout maybe the first series, with the long black dreadlocks. Do you know who I'm talking about?
Yeah, I know exactly who you're talking about.
Yeah, like who's she? Because there's definitely one episode, and it might be the first one off the top of my head, where Del Boy knows that he's hurt Rodney quite bad, and like he looks at her and she gives him a proper look, and it's like he drops his head and he's like, "Yeah, I think I've done bad there." Like, who's she? What's
Yeah,
her
I don't
name?
know. I know they used to use the same extras over and over again. This is why you kind of like get the whole feeling of a real legitimate pub because of the regulars that are there. But yeah, it is interesting to keep an eye out on the extras and find out what all their backstory and stuff is. Right, I'm just gonna hit play. So Del Boy's showing off all of his folded notes again, saying how much of a good day that he's had. He's quite chipper, isn't he? He's got himself a full pint. And Rodney
No,
sat there.
that's unusual, Chris, isn't it? How often do we see him drinking a pint?
No, we don't. Yeah, it is strange. But yeah, maybe it's before he transitioned into his exotic cocktails.
Yeah, maybe. I think it's just a physical way of showing how well he's doing.
Yeah,
Big pint.
possibly.
Yeah, Rodney's got nothing, you know?
Was it like a folder that packet of crisps or some pork scratchings or something Rodney's got in front of him?
Yeah, he's got like a little packet of KP or something,
Oh
hasn't
yeah,
he?
maybe it's nuts, isn't it? But I guess Rodney sat there quietly confident, isn't he? Because he's about to break the news, actually, that it hasn't all failed for him. Things have actually worked out.
Yeah, he's sitting there and he's like, you can imagine Del Boy's at the bar. Like Rodney would have been sitting there thinking, some great news. I can't wait to tell him. He's gonna never gonna believe it. And then
Yeah.
obviously it falls apart. Yeah.
And he notices, because Rodney's got his legs up on the chair, and kind of there's a scene where Dal leans over and looks at his sole flapping off of his shoes.
Yeah, Del's shoes back again. So we'll get
So,
to that payoff again.
now they're having a bit of a heart to heart, aren't they? And they're like, come on, let's just, blood is thicker than water. Let's just go back to how we were.
That's it. All right,
So
so
now put all your money onto the table then. Let's get business back on track again.
see what I like about this is Del thinks that Towser didn't pay Rodney at all. Which is great because you think, oh yeah, maybe he like double crossed him, but no, it's better than that.
Well, he took 35 quid off of him.
Yeah, he did, but that's fair enough because Del Boy was going to give him 20 and then he paid the bill, didn't he? So that's what I mean. Towser got his revenge, but then as the audience, you're sitting there thinking, oh no, he's like taking the whole money, like because they'll like pissed him off.
Yeah, I
But
guess it could always be worse.
exactly, but then probably drops the.
So Dale's lost £35 due to his own doing, basically just trying to teach Rodney a lesson. And £35 back then was a hell of a lot of money, I can imagine.
Yeah, but it's worse than that, isn't it? Because Rodney's taken the other 165 and reinvested it in more Lomo engines.
Isn't that such fantastic writing? It's like next game on top of next game on top of next game writing, isn't it? John Sullivan was an absolute genius. There's so many things in this he could have taken away and it still would have been fantastic, but yet he's built on top of these amazing ideas that he had. I
Yeah.
don't know how to describe it. He's literally a genius, isn't he?
He really is. I can't speak highly enough of him, actually. And one of my ex-girlfriends, her dad was a postman, and he actually was John Sullivan's postman.
Oh, was he?
Yeah, and I only found this out late into our relationship, so I didn't get a chance to really sort of ask him like where he lives, so I could like maybe just write him a letter, just sort of say, thanks for all the laughs and what you do and that sort of stuff, unfortunately. But yeah, I'll just he's a real inspiration to me, he really is. I wish I'd met him.
Well, I'm just going to hit pause a second. So, I've got some friends who are in the West End musical of Only Fools and Horses, and
Yeah.
I've been speaking to them actually, and they're quite close with Jim Sullivan because of the show. So there's a small chance that he may be on this podcast fairly soon, but I can't say too much because nothing is set in stone yet. But that's definitely something that I am personally working towards, and the cogs and the wheels are in motion for that to happen. So watch this space.
Fantastic, mate. I shall tune in avidly if that comes off. Yeah, that'd be awesome.
So we're coming to the end of the episode now.
Yeah, we've got the apocryphal tale of the rubber band and the shoe, which shows John Sullivan wasn't averse to kind of outside influences that weren't strictly things that he'd learned himself, I guess, because there's always that tale of someone taking off the rubber band and giving it to someone to do their shoe up or whatever with a bit of a pithy remark. And he managed to wangle it in, yeah.
It's a classic Sullivan thing, isn't it? Just squeezing out a last little joke before the credits roll.
Yeah, that's the thing. Like most comedies would be satisfied with Towser's double crossed him and taken all the money and just told Rodney there might be some more lawnmower engines somewhere else. But he just takes it on another step and then another step as well. Yeah. And he's only got half an hour to play with. You know, I'm so glad they went to the 50 minutes like later on because you just get more bang for your buck.
I think John Sullivan was famous for saying there should be a gag in every line that he writes.
Well, I mean, he wasn't far off, was he?
I know that sounds quite excessive. I think it was every line.
I mean, well,
I can't remember the exact quote now.
Yeah, I don't know if that would really work. I mean, because you need to have some sort of like plot development and stuff, which doesn't necessitate a laugh all the time.
Maybe it was every page. That would probably make more sense.
There you go. One a page. That'd work. Yeah.
Well, and he definitely succeeded in healthy competition.
Oh, well, yeah. Great. Come on. Are we going to give it a rating then, mate? What are we saying?
Well, then you go first. So what is your mark out of 10 for healthy competition?
I mean, I can't go any lower than a 9, really. I mean, I can't. It's what more do you want? It's kind of a perfect tight episode, 28 minutes long or whatever it is. And there's not a boring bit in it. And, you know, why don't I give it a 10? Well, maybe I could give it a 10. I don't know.
What would make it better for you? If there's one element that you could add to it, which would bring it to a 10, what would it be?
I would. Do you know what? If this was a 50-minute episode, I would like to see a little bit more development of the Rodney-Mickey relationship. Maybe see them at another auction or see them doing some sort of deal that goes a bit awry.
Yeah.
You know, that sort of thing. But that's just kind of like padding it out. You know, it's not really a complaint.
How cool would it have been to see Mickey Pearce on holiday?
It would have been pretty fun, wouldn't it?
Yeah. Imagine cutting to like Mickey Pearce somewhere in the sun, spending all this money. Well, actually, no, he wouldn't be spending any money because he's presumably spent it all going on the holiday. But just certainly scenes of him enjoying himself, just kind of like raveling in Rodney's dismay.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, I think maybe if he'd been a bit more of an established character, like he'd been in a couple more episodes before that, that would have worked a bit better. But yeah, that would have been awesome. I don't really think, like, you can't really add too much to this episode, I don't think, without literally just extending it, you know?
Yeah. I wonder what John Sullivan's plan was for Patrick Murray in the character of Mickey Pearce, whether or not he was destined to be an ongoing thing or whether or not he was written just as a one-off. What do you think and what do you know?
Well, I think what we said near the beginning of the podcast, that he got spotted off of the telly, and the exclamation was, "We found our Mickey Pearce." So it sounds like it was an ongoing situation for a character that they wanted to have long term.
I think he helped the dynamic between Rodney and Dale so much in this episode.
Yes, I agree. And I think it's good to have Rodney needs some peers, because obviously Dale Boy's, you know, so much older than him. Like, it's good for Rodney to be seen mixing with peers of his own age, to give us a kind of a more, like back then, obviously, a more contemporary feel to his life, because, you know, he doesn't necessarily want to go to the curry house all the time like Dale does. He wants to go to the roller disco and the pizza parlor, and he needs friends to do that, you know?
Yeah, no, I agree. Well, for me, I think I could probably give the episode a 9 as well, which is a really high score, but it's just got all the elements in it, hasn't it? It seems the characters have found their feet. The script is fantastic. You know, it's just setting up such a high standard for the rest of the series. So it's definitely a 9 from me. And if it could be made into a 10, it would be to see Mickey Pearce jollying up on holiday with his new girlfriend and perhaps maybe talking about Rodney briefly and maybe cutting back to Rodney in the flat looking really miserable, sort of coincide with what we already see. But yeah, it's definitely a 9 from me.
Well, if we're doing a little bit of script writing, in that case, I would like to see, as John Sullivan often does, a little bit of pathos where Mickey goes to the bar at some point with Helga and he reveals that he's got no money, and she just turns around and walks off, and he has a moment of reflection and thinks,
That would be good, but I'm sure, as tragic as that sounds, and I probably would feel a bit sorry for Mickey if that happened, John Sullivan would found a way to make that absolutely hilarious.
Oh yeah, no, it would. There would definitely be an element of humour of it, but I think that he just a moment of reflection where he thinks to himself, "I've left poor Rodney back at home, and for what? She was only interested in my money." Do you know what
yeah.
I mean?
Yeah, that would have been a good shout, actually. That would have been a really good thing to add. So generally speaking, are you more of a fan of the early series than the later, or do you not have a preference, or is it a bit of both?
I love it all. I love it all. I can't lie. I mean, I find myself probably watching the kind of middle to later stuff more. Sort of when they introduced the 50 minutes and the ladies came into it, etc. But if, as I said at the beginning, if any episode comes on the telly and I've got nothing else going on or I want something in the background, I'll have it on.
Okay. So what about a favourite season? Series? I'm asking for trouble, aren't I? I'm watching too many American seasons on Netflix at the moment, and it's just keeps tripping me up. So what is your favourite series of Only Fools and Horses?
Do you know what? I can't categorise it like that in my head, if that makes sense.
Not Series 7?
Is that the last of the half an hours, or is that the start of the 50s?
That's Yuppie Love.
Yuppie Love. Yeah, well, exactly. I mean, those tales are superb, all of those. I mean, season four is quite good because of the way it starts with like the granddad's funeral and stuff. Like, that's such a gut-wrenching but hilarious episode. But that's the thing. I can't, in my head, I'm like, oh, series three's got that, and that. To me, I just think of an episode and I can talk about it and it's just all one, you know?
Yeah. That's a good way to be, I think, to be open-minded and enjoy every episode that John Sullivan gave us.
Absolutely, absolutely.
Well, it's been really, really good having you on the podcast and hearing your stories of meeting Patrick Murray at previous conventions. We look forward to sharing that photograph of your signed picture of Mickey Pierce.
I will get it across to you. Yeah, thanks for having us on, Chris. Really enjoyed it. And I recommend it to anyone else who's out there maybe listening to drop you a line on Twitter and get involved.
Before you go, have you seen the musical?
I have, yes.
Oh, go on then. What's your verdict?
I really liked it. I thought it was a good stab at putting it across. And some of the songs were really funny. My favourite bit was at the dating agency.
Fantastic. Oscar Conlon Murray, who plays the dating agency guy, he's amazing, isn't he? He's such a good actor.
Yeah, he nailed it really well. And the lyrics for the song just had me in stitches. It was great, yeah. But as an overall
bit,
piece,
bit of a sort.
That's it, yeah. Bit of a sort.
I listen to the soundtrack regularly on Spotify. It's such a good soundtrack. And it's true to Only Fools and Horses because it was co-written, wasn't it, by Chas Hodges, I believe, in Paul Whitehouse.
Right, yeah. R.I.P. Chas. I love Chas and Dave. They're brilliant. That scene in Dates when he's at the dating agency is like one of my all-time favourite singular scenes.
That was Tom, who normally does the podcast with us. He was raving about that. It's funny, actually. He drove us both up and because I hadn't seen it, it was the second time seeing it, and he kept on about this one specific scene of like the song, a bit of a sort, and he was talking about the dating agency scene. He said, oh, you really need to see it. Anyway, when we were in London, it was one of the hottest days of the year, and we were walking around because we stopped off to see Harlech Tower, which is the original flat of Nelson Mandela House. So I went and took some photographs of that. Then we walked to the West End, and I drank so much water because it was so hot. Honestly, I was absolutely boiling. And I really need to go to the toilet during the performance. And of course, I got up to go, so I literally couldn't hold it anymore. And I missed the whole scene that Tom was talking about the whole way up there that he really wanted me to see. So I was a bit gutted about that. But I've managed to relive it on YouTube, and I've listened to the soundtrack several times on Spotify. But it is definitely up there with one of my favourite scenes from the musical.
Chateau Neuf de Pape.
Yeah, I know. A la Bruchette. That's exactly what I thought. But, you know, it is what it is. But I was glad to have the opportunity to go out there and see it. Were you lucky enough to see Paul Whitehouse's granddad?
Yes, thankfully I was. Normally when I go to these theatre things, I always miss the big names. And it's like, you know, the next person that comes in or whatever. But yeah, thankfully, Mr. Whitehouse was involved in this one. And it always tickles me that, forgive me, I can't remember the guy's name, but Del Boy in it is the chap from Phone Shop.
That's right, Mr. Tom Bennett.
Tom Bennett, that's it. And Phone Shop was filmed in my hometown. And I accidentally ruined a scene that they were filming once.
When you say accidentally, do you mean you did it on purpose just to try and get your 15 minutes of fame?
Well, I mean, it's far be it for me to say, Chris, to be honest. No, but what happened was they were filming just inside the doorway of our local Morrison's. And I was going in there to pick up some provisions. And as I've had my head down, I was probably looking at my phone or my iPod or something. And as I've walked through the double doors, which opened, so it's not really my fault because they should have had them locked, really. Mm-hmm. I've literally looked up and they've got lighting, a camera, a couple of the actors. And I've literally looked up and gone, oh, sorry. And the director's like, cut, like that. And I was like, oh, I've embarrassed myself here. And I.
Well, you know what they needed, don't you?
Go on.
A lookout.
And there end of the podcast.
There you go. What an end. Anyway, thanks very much for coming on. It's really good to chat to you. Thanks again for supporting the podcast. And we look forward to speaking with you soon.
Yeah, pleasure, mate. I'll be happy to come back on in the future when you've run out of other willing participants. No problem.
Nice one, mate. All right, take care.
You too. Thanks, Chris.
Fabrique Belgique.
Get out, you noisy little kid.
Look out, Margot, and look up your daughters, eh?